When I announced the topic of today's talk, Danzig and Gdansk, a footnote to recent Polish history, one of you said to me, what two cities are you talking about? And I answered, I'm not Charles Dickens. This is not a tale of two cities. Danzig is simply the German name, and Gdansk, the Polish name of a port city at the mouth of the Vistula River, the major river system of Poland, where it flows into the Baltic Sea. And the very fact that this town, this port town, has two names suggests it's what is true of its history, that since it was founded nearly 1,000 years ago, it has been a shuttlecock between the German peoples and the Polish peoples, each one in turn claiming sovereignty. Apparently, around the year 1000, this little port was founded by Polish-speaking peoples. And then after a series of tribal-related vicissitudes, around the year 1358, it was conquered by the Germanic order of the Knights Teutonic, and it remained in their possession until 1468, when it was captured by the Polish king, renamed Gdansk. And during the subsequent several centuries, Gdansk was actually the major port city on the Baltic, the most prosperous, and at times the most populous city in all of Poland. Through it, when rivers were still the main means of transportation into Europe, through it all the goods that went into Poland and Central Europe had to pass. And then in 1772, 1773, somewhat after the heyday of this port, other ports had now begun to compete with it. Overland transportation was now easier. Sometime around 1772, when the first of the four modern partitions of Poland took place, Prussia claimed Gdansk, renamed it Danzig, resettled it with a largely German population. It was a provincial center of Poland, of Prussia, and then of Germany during most of the 19th century, and it remained so up to and through the First World War. You may remember that during the First World War, the Allies promised the minorities of Eastern Europe nationality. They promised Lithuanians, the Latvians, the Estonians that they would have a country of their own. And of course, Poland was to come back and to become a nation again. Now, Poland desperately needed a port on the Baltic if these countries of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia were to be carved out of her coastland areas. And she demanded Gdansk. But since Gdansk had Danzig had a largely German population, the solution at the end of the war was to give Poland the corridor of land which surrounds Danzig, but to allow Danzig to remain a free city under the authority of the League of Nations. Free city, a largely German city, and it remained so until 1939, when the fourth of the modern partitions of Poland took place, when the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact was signed, and the Reich claimed Danzig again for itself. During the Second World War, Danzig was a part of the Reich, and after the war, when Russia had overrun Eastern Europe, Russia, you'll recall, gobbled up large amounts of eastern Poland and declared them to be within Russian boundaries, took some of eastern Germany and declared it to be within the Polish border, and that included the area of Danzig, which was then renamed Gdansk. The German population was forced out, and Gdansk was resettled with a Polish population, largely from those areas of eastern Poland, which were now part of Russia, and which Russia wanted to be largely free of their indigenous Polish population. That's the background of Gdansk, until it suddenly erupted into the news again. We were reminded of it because of the existence there of the Lenin shipyards, the place where the first strikes occurred, which led to the establishment of an independent Polish labor union, the Solidarity, under the leadership of this young 38-year-old Lech Walesa. Of course, the establishment of this independent labor union has been a cause of great embarrassment to Poland and to the Soviet, to the communist bloc, and a cause of great interest to those of us who are outside of Poland. Many of us have been under the innocent, and not so innocent, misapprehension that communist ideology and the actuality of communist rule are one and the same thing. And the idea that the workers of a communist state have, in a sense, to distance themselves from the state apparatus, which, according to ideology, is committed only to their well-being, suggests in a very dramatic way what is the reality of power in a communist society, and that is that after a revolution, those who win the revolution are still unredeemed men and women. They have their own interests to remain in power. They have their own interests to use power for the benefit of those who are part of the apparatus. They have their own interests, which are personal and to a certain degree inevitably corrupted by the power which they wield. In Poland, it turns out that those who are in the party bureaucracy and those who are in the puppet union, which had been sponsored by the government supposedly to take to do the things which a union ought to do for its membership, that these people were earning salaries of 100,000 zlotys or more a month, that they were allowed to buy food in stores which were reserved for them, that they were given special large apartments at beneficial rates, that they had all the advantages of the elite in any capitalist society, while the workers, who were presumably equal to them, the workers had an income of 5 to 10,000 zlotys a month. They lived with minimal foods. Food is rationed in Poland, meats particularly. They had to pay full cost for their apartments, which were far less grand than those which their labor bosses and political bosses enjoyed. And what is true, of course, in Poland has been true in the Soviet Union, is true throughout the countries of Eastern Europe. And so the workers of Poland banded together to demand what the workers of the capitalist West, the repressive capitalist West, have had now for several generations: the rights to a union which represents their interests, the rights to negotiate openly and to strike when necessary against the factories and the industries where they work, a 5-day week, a 40-hour week, decent pay for the work which they put out. And we've watched with interest and with some fear the emergence of Solidarity, because we know that the communist governments do not scruple to use power to repress those who complain or criticize or band together in anti-social, anti-revolutionary activity. We remember Hungary, we remember Czechoslovakia, we remember the Stalin purges. We know that in the East, at least, power can be used and is used often, and we wonder just how far the Polish lords, the heads of the Communist Party, the Russians, will allow this independent socio-political labor movement to go. We wonder that it's gone this far, most of us. We know that there are 52 Soviet divisions on and around the Polish border. We know that Russia cannot allow Poland to slip out of the Warsaw Pact to become something else but a Soviet satellite. It would expose East Germany, which would then be caught between two powers inimical to the Soviet interests. We wonder that Things have been allowed to go as far as they have, which suggests simply that this is a totally popular mass movement, and that those who are in charge of the apparatus have decided that they have to let some of the steam escape before they begin the repression, before they begin to bring the society back into line. Now, what happened in Poland? A number of things. The first, the exposure, as we should have known from other cases, particularly in the Soviet Union, of the fact that central planning is not all that it is cracked up to be. In America, our governments complain, our presidents always complain, that Congress stands in the way of central planning. That if only they had the power administratively to organize the economy, we wouldn't have inflation, we wouldn't have falling productivity, we wouldn't have some of the economic ills that we do. Well, in the Soviet Union, in the People's Republic of Poland, the government can do exactly what it wishes to do with the economy. And there has been inflation, and there has been a failure of productivity, and there has been something far worse, and that is massive bad judgment, which has led the economy down lines for ideological reasons which it ought never to have gone. There is no mechanism of the marketplace to act as a balance, a standard against which one makes economic judgments. In the early 1970s, Poland began to borrow heavily from the West to reindustrialize its society, a word which we Americans have become familiar with in recent months and ought to be a little bit wary of because of the Polish experience. They began to reindustrialize the society by borrowing billions of dollars from the West. They were going to build factories to produce goods which could be sold to the West. But then the OPEC nations struck, and the energy bill of Poland, which is entirely dependent upon the Soviet Union for her energy, grew and grew apace. And the West went into the OPEC period of stagflation and was not prepared to buy many of the goods that Poland was now producing. And the apparatus of the Polish economy proved lethargic. I'm told that there are factories in Poland which were begun 10 years ago, which have yet to produce their first spool, their first machine. The economy is not finely tuned or highly geared. And so after a year or two of a boomlet, 1970, 71, if you recall those years, you may recall that people were beginning to talk of a Polish miracle, the same way they talked of a German miracle. Polish inflation began to hit the economy. The economy tried to produce millions of jobs for the workers, was not able to do so, and it began to restrict the luxury goods and then to restrict food because it didn't have the money with which to buy some of the necessary foods, especially meats, in the foreign markets. And this 1976, there were some food riots, there were a few minor strikes, and finally this 1980 scenario of solidarity. Now, another set of factors has to be considered. Poland exists on a flat plateau of land, which traditionally rests between the hills and the forests of Central Europe, of Germany, and the Pripet marshes and the flatlands of Russia. And it has been a corridor to power, where the Teutonic peoples and the Russian peoples have crossed and crisscrossed with their armies time and again. In many ways, geopolitically, it's exactly like the state of Israel. Israel, Lebanon, and Jordan are in that narrow corridor of land where the powerful empires to the east and the west, Assyria, Babylon, and Egypt, have crossed and recrossed as they fought for dominance in that part of the world. Well, Poland is the land that the armies of Germany and the armies of Russia have crossed and recrossed over the centuries. In the 18th and 19th centuries, as Poland began to try and emerge, to try and develop into its own sense of sovereignty, it found itself cut between these powers, East and West. And the Catholic Church in Poland began to play the same role that the Catholic Church plays in Ireland. Once the partitions of Poland had taken place, beginning in 1770, you could not meet openly in a nationalist cause, but you could go to church. And so the church became the nationalist cell. And because Lutheran Prussia was on the west, Russian Orthodox Russia was on the east, the Slavic nations were to the south with their Greek Orthodox and their Muslim traditions. Roman Catholicism became a banner of nationalism as well as a faith to the Polish peoples. And it's estimated even today, 30 some odd years into the communist-dominated school experiment, into the communist-dominated state, with all of the propaganda apparatus at its control, that 90+% of the Polish people are members of the church, and 75% are still active in their churches. This has led to the fact that alone, uniquely among the satellite countries of the Soviet in the post-war years, Poland has gone through a population explosion. I'm told that 70% of the population of Poland is under 35 years of age. Of the workers in the Lenin shipyard at Gdansk, the average age of the worker is 24, which suggests that there is a division, a generational division between the workers and the communist bosses, but also suggests there's a great deal of youthful dynamism involved in among the workers who are demanding more and more, and the control is becoming a very difficult one. And as you've seen from the news of the last months, one of the things that Wałęsa and his colleagues have been trying to do is to temper the demands so that they don't go too far, too fast, because clearly things are in a very bad shape. Now, nationalism and the Roman Catholic Church and the population explosion are part of this equation. Another part of the equation is the Roman Catholic Church and the Communist Party of Poland, which suggests that there will be, and that relationship suggests that there will be limits to how far this trade union movement is allowed to grow. In the 1950s, a concordat was entered into between the Catholic Church and the Communist Party of Poland, which was essentially a live and let live agreement. The church agreed not to become the center for an anti-party underground. The government agreed to allow the church to have some schools, to build some new churches, to ordain priests, to bring in priests from the outside, to send its priests to the outside for training and the like. And it's very important to the Roman Catholic Church in Poland, which is, of course, the dominant church, that the terms of this arrangement be continued. Because the church knows that if the Soviet Union marches in with its tanks, the Soviet Union will have no interest in entering this kind of arrangement with the Roman Church. The Roman Church is weak in the Soviet Union. The Communist Party is much stronger in proportion to the total population in the Soviet Union. And the Roman Catholic community knows that it will not receive the kind of preferential treatment it is now receiving at the hands of the Soviet invasion. And so in August of 1980, there was a synod of Polish bishops which expressed solidarity with solidarity, which said that there ought to be negotiations, open negotiations between labor and the government, but also warned solidarity not to go too far, to be temperate in its demands, not to resort to violence, to remember that one had to be concerned with what was at the borders. The church is concerned, therefore, don't tempt fate. All of this suggests, given the 52 divisions of the Soviet, given the very effective KGB of the Polish government itself, given the Polish army, which is still at the beck and call of the Polish government, given the interests of the Roman Catholic Church, all of this suggests that there will be, in fact, limits to how far solidarity will be able to go, that we will not see what some have begun to talk about, the emergence of a democratic Poland. Not at all. There will be an independent labor union. It will have a 5-day week, 4 of the 5 weeks of the month. It will have some rights to negotiate openly, but I doubt that, seriously, that it will be allowed to grow into an oppositional force. It will grow much further. Now, I called this talk this morning a footnote to recent Polish history. And I did so because I, in a sense, as a rabbi, I see things through Jewish eyes. And of course, there's been no Jewish component in the Lenin shipyard strike. There are less than 6,000 elderly Jews in all of Poland. There were 3,500,000 Jews in Poland just 45 years ago. But interestingly, by chance, an exhibit was planned at the Jewish Museum in New York for this last year, coincidental with the emergence of Poland into our headlines, which was called Danzig 1939. And I'd thought about Danzig even before Danzig began to appear as Gdansk in our papers. Now, this exhibit consists of some hundreds of Jewish ceremonial objects, ritual objects, which belonged to the synagogue gemeinde, the central synagogue of Danzig, and which were brought over to the United States in 1938. And I'd like to tell you the story of this exhibit, behind this exhibit, to remind you a little bit about the history and the relationship of Jews in Gdansk and Jews in Poland, because I think it has some relevance to the larger issue. Jews enjoyed during the Middle Ages relatively happy circumstances in Poland, but not in Gdansk. In Poland, as a whole, Jews provided much of the literate middle class, the auditors, the accountants, the lawyers, the purveyors, the business folk, the secretaries, the farm managers that the Polish pans required. Poland was a two-class society, the pans, the nobility, who were interested in their estates and their hunting, the peasantry, who were bound to the land, and only the Jews were, in a sense, operating in between, providing the middle class. Gdansk was an exception. Gdansk was a mercantile city, and the guilds and the merchants of Gdansk wanted nothing of Jewish competition. So during most of the Polish occupation of Gdansk in the Middle Ages, Jews were prohibited domicile in the city. A few families lived in the countryside around, but none in the city itself. The Jewish community of Gdansk began to emerge there only when Gdansk became Danzig. It was a German community. It was a community of German Jews who came to this provincial center for business reasons during the late 18th and early 19th century. Danzig never had a Jewish population of more than 2,500 souls, men, women, and children. It was, as a German community, a liberal German community. It had a reform rabbi already by the 1850s. It had an attitude towards reform which was, in a sense, classic. It wanted nothing to do with Zionism. It wanted nothing to do with a sense of Jewish community. We often use the phrase, you know, Germans of the Mosaic persuasion. Well, that's what the Jews of Danzig were. Danzigiers, Zigiats, of the Mosaic persuasion. They had and built in the 1880s a magnificent synagogue. It was in the central part of Danzig. It was a large Arabic Moorish cathedral kind of building which sat 1,600 people. It's interesting that in the era when Reformed Jews were Mosaists, they came to shul. In the era where Jews are Jews, they don't necessarily come to shul, but that's another story. This building was in the center of downtown. It was a statement as the main temple of our congregation. Many of the buildings were built in the late 19th and early 20th century, that we Jews are part of the society. We're no longer hiding our buildings. We want you to see us. We want you to know we're there. You're welcome to come in. There's nothing secret that's happening here. This isn't a Mason's Lodge. Anything is here is open. We're proud of what we do. One of the members of this synagogue was a man named Lieser Gilzinski, who was a rather well-to-do wheat and barley merchant. And Mr. Gilzinski was something of an art collector. And it was his collection of Jewish ceremonial objects which he gave, which was given by him on his 75th birthday in 1904 to the synagogue, which was an exhibit last year at the Jewish Museum in New York. Now, as long as Danzig remained Danzig, the Jewish community remained small. But once Danzig became the free city of Danzig under League of Nations protection after the First World War, Danzig became the focus of a large number of Eastern European, particularly Polish Jews, who wanted to flee. You didn't need a visa to enter Danzig or to leave Danzig. And so if you wanted to come to the United States, you wanted to come to England, South Africa, wherever you wanted to go, Palestine, if you get to Danzig, you could get out. And Danzig became one of the great entrepôts for Jews in movement in the 1920s and 1930s. And just as we maintained in Vienna a transit camp for Jews on the way out of the Soviet Union in the last 20 years, so the Hayas and the JDC maintained in Danzig during most of the 20s and 30s a transit camp for Polish Jews, Eastern European Jews, on their way out from Eastern Europe. The entrance of Eastern European Jews into Danzig created community problems. These were the Ostjuden. These Jews spoke Yiddish, not German. They were different than the Danzigers. And they tried to keep them in the camp. And when those settled who wanted to settle because there was good business to be done in Danzig, the synagogue Gemeinde, the old German Jewish establishment, tried to keep these people from having the rights to vote so that their views, their Zionist views, would not be able to be expressed. Slowly, though, in the 30s, as Nazism spread in Germany and the German population of Danzig began to vote heavily for the Nazi party, the Danzigers themselves began to understand that a Mosaist was in fact a Jew, and they began to make the motions towards coming together and organizing for their self-defense. In 1937, there were a series of pogroms and riots in Danzig. Half of the community left within the year. Some of it was able to get to Scandinavia, to England. Most of it went back into Poland, figuring that Poland would be a place that was safer than the Germans' population might provide. In 1938, we have Kristallnacht. There were four synagogues in Danzig. Three of them were burned to the ground, all except the Great Synagogue, which was protected by their version of the Jewish Defense League, which does have its uses from time to time. The Great Synagogue, however, could not be sustained. And finally, following the suggestion of a Zionist leader, Hermann Segel, the community entered into a rather interesting agreement with the Nazi government of Danzig. The agreement was to this effect, that they would sell to the city for a fraction of its value this great synagogue building, and that they would get the right to sell to the United States their ceremonial art collection. And this money would be used to expedite the travel of Jews from Danzig. The Germans wanted the Jews out. The money that was involved would all come back to them in any case. It was a good bargain for them. The Jews saw no alternative. And so in April of 1938, because the Germans wanted everything to be in order, all of the householders of Danzig had to come to the synagogue, and the agreement was read out, and the German Gauleiter of the town insisted that the Jews rise en masse to signal their acceptance of the terms of the sale of the building and the sale of their museum collection, and that they sign the document making this official, and it was so done, and the ceremonial objects were shipped off to New York, and the 5,000 Jews of Danzig who remained began to shift for themselves to try and escape. A number of the children got out in one of the children's trains to Great Britain. Many of the Poles went back into Poland, fearing that this was a way to escape from the Germans. They were wrong. Many of the Danzigers were able to get to Scandinavia and to Latin America. A goodly number of them entered the illegal underground and tried to get into Palestine. And a large number of the passengers in the ship Patria, which was one of those illegal ships which tried to make it through the British blockade and which was blown up with considerable loss of life in Haifa Harbor, were from Danzig. A number of others were caught en route and spent the war in Mauritania, which was one of the camps which was maintained by the British for the unwanted illegal, so-called illegal Jewish immigrants into Palestine. There is no more Danzig Jewish community. There has been no Danzig Jewish community, no Gdansk Jewish community since the Second World War. But there were these objects in New York, and in honor of the 40th anniversary of the destruction of this community, The Jewish Museum planned this exhibit and had a number of fine curators and museum people prepare a catalog. And they found a number of Danzigers who now live in the United States. They were brought to the opening and they testified to, they found themselves in photographs. They remembered how certain objects had been used. And there was a sense of continuity. And now these exhibits, these objects are in the permanent collection of the Jewish Museum in New York, and you can see many of them on display there if you visit. All of this serves to remind us of an interesting fact of recent Polish Jewish history. We tend to think simplistically that the Holocaust was German, that once the Holocaust was over, it was over. That tragedy was over for the Jews. But I would remind you that in 1947, 2 years after the end of the war, there were 350 to 400,000 Jews in Poland. And any number of these Jews had positions in the government, in education, in the sciences, in industry. A Jewish community was on the way to being reestablished. But then there were pogroms in Poland in 46 and 47. Millions of Poles had taken over land, houses, farms, furniture, wealth that belonged to the Jews. It belonged to the Jews who lived there before the war, and they didn't want the Jews coming back and reclaiming what had been theirs. And during that first three-year period, about half of the Jewish population of Poland had had enough. And they picked up and they went as soon as the gates of Palestine were open. And then in 1956, with the fall of Stalin, there was a Khrushchev kind of purge of Stalinists in Poland, as there was in the Soviet Union. And the Soviet communist group in Poland blamed the Jews for all the ills under Stalin. And a number of Jews were purged from various offices, and there were pogroms again, and there was a second emigration of Jews from Poland. In 1967 and 68, there were further anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic outbursts in Poland. Now the Gromyka government was under pressure from the Soviet Union for various economic reasons. It was accused of, and they accused the Jews who were still in the apparatus of the government of being the cause of all of Poland's ills. And a general by the name of Mukhtar, you may remember, went out on a series of anti-Semitic tirades to purge Poland of its Jews. And the Jews were, in fact, purged from all areas of Polish life, and another emigration of Jews took place from Poland. In 1970, there were a series of student riots in the universities, having to do with the quality of education, having to do with their future and their opportunities. And again, the Jewish intellectuals were blamed for these riots. And again, all the ills of Poland were blamed on her Jews. In 1976, there were food riots in Poland. And again, the Jews were blamed for the bad crops and for the economic ills of the city, of the community. Now, during these earlier episodes, one could always find some real live Jews to blame. It's going to be interesting to see who Poland blames now that there are really no live Jews around to point the finger at. But if you hear and read in the papers a Jewish-sounding name, if you find some diatribe or other by one of the members of the Kania government, the present Communist Party government, suddenly speaking about subversion from intelligentsia, the responsibility of the revisionists for what's happening in Poland, look carefully for the Jewish element. It's in there someplace. Poland has one of the longest, saddest, most wretched histories in all of Europe in terms of anti-Semitism. The church in Poland, being a nationalist church, has very little of the breadth of vision which one would hope a church would have towards people of other communities. When the present Polish Pope, John Paul II, visited Warsaw 2 years ago, he was the first Polish prelate of ever in history to make any reference to the fact that Jews fought with the Poles against the Nazis. The Warsaw Ghetto had in fact taken place in that millions of Polish Jews had died along with millions of Poles. It was a passing reference, but it was a reference nevertheless. It may be that the Polish community is finally coming of age. Solidarity may signal that. Willing to look at its problems as its problems and not in terms of stereotypes. But if the stereotype solutions are sought, I can assure you that the stereotype which will be held, which will be lifted up is the anti-Semitic stereotype, the stereotype of the Jew. That's the way it's always been in Poland. And I'm afraid that's the way it's going to be for some time to come. Amen.